to the New World. Episode 3, Sailing the Ocean Blue. Last time, I talked about the conditions in Europe in general, and Iberia in specific, that led to the exploration of Africa and later America. Before I begin, let me make some clarifications. Last time, I mentioned King Fernando of Aragon, but I also called him Ferdinand. Just so you know, that's an anglicization of the name, and both names are correct. If I call Fernando Ferdinand, or Ferdinand Fernando, just know I'm talking about the same person. Also, throughout this episode, I'll be referring to a Spanish people, but just know that Castile and Aragon are still technically separate kingdoms, and they won't be united for a few centuries more. I'll be referring to the Castilians, or Aragonese, or Basques as Spanish for simplicity's sake, but just keep that in mind. Now, I'll talk about the biggest name in this whole age, the man who looms large over everything that is about to come, Christopher Columbus. Of course, that isn't his real name, only an anglicization. He was born as Cristoforo Colombo in the Republic of Genoa in 1451. His Latinized name, Christophorus Columbus, has been adapted in virtually every European language, much in the same way as monarchs. The Spanish called him Cristobal Colón. Anyone who knows anything about Columbus knows how controversial he is. To some, he's a pioneer and a visionary, a man who brought about a new age in an interconnected world, the man who Americans can look to as almost some kind of ancestor. To many others, he is like a horseman of the apocalypse, a man whose arrival would signal the conquest, death, and enslavement of millions, not to mention his own numerous personal faults. Whatever the case, Columbus is the man who will really start the transformation of the Americas, for good or ill. Let's get back to the facts, though. When Columbus was born in 1451, which I feel compelled to remind you is a time where there was still technically a legitimate Roman emperor, the Republic of Genoa was one of many Italian city-states, including Florence and Venice. These merchant republics, or maritime republics as they were known, made a killing off of trading across the Mediterranean Sea. They traded in all kinds of goods with all kinds of people, and received quite a bit of disapproval from their more religious neighbors for having no qualms with including Muslims in their clientele. The wealthy merchant families ruled over these cities in a way that may make it seem like an oligarchy, and business was booming for them. Merchant enclaves belonging to Genoa and Venice and Ragusa could be found in a great many ports in Europe, and the states themselves controlled territory wherever they could. Genoa, in particular, owned islands in the Aegean Sea and ports in modern Crimea. Events like the Crusades and the Mongol conquests only expanded their markets and influence. The pursuit of goods and clients led these merchants to travel even further afield from Europe. There is hardly a more famous example than the Venetian traveler Marco Polo, who visited the court of Kublai Khan in China in the late 1200s. My source for this episode, Rivers of Gold, The Rise of the Spanish Empire by Hugh Thomas, claims that a Genoese family known as the Vivaldi sent ships across the Atlantic to find a sea route to India at around the same time, but they were never seen again. Various nations also had Italian advisors helping them build and staff their navies. One example of this is, of course, Portugal, who had Genoese merchants and explorers travel across the West African coast and establish colonies there. Thomas even claims that the Portuguese navy itself had been founded by a Genoese man, whose descendants still claimed the title of admiral for themselves. Wherever these Genoese went, they also sought profit. They founded sugar plantations in Cape Verde and brought salt back from Tunis or gold from Ceuta. They also specialized in the slave trade, and were not particular in who they sold into bondage, no matter the race or religion. You might be expecting me to say something along the lines of, "But no family in Genoa was more famous than the Columbus family," or something like that. But that isn't actually true. Columbus's father, Domenico, was a weaver by trade, and his sister made the family proud when she married a cheese merchant. His other brothers, Bartolomeo and Diego, followed Cristoforo wherever he went. Some speculated that he may have been even partially Jewish in ancestry, but I'm not sure how true that is. In 1472, when he was 21, he went on his first voyage to Tunis, and then to the Greek island of Chios, then to Lisbon in 1476, then Ireland, and maybe even Iceland. Consider that through all of this, Columbus was simply a crewman of various Genoese trading families, and you begin to see why their city was known as a maritime republic. Around 1477, he got a job selling sugar from a plantation on the island of Madeira, and married the daughter of a Portuguese governor, whose family had a long history and connections, including taking part in several battles against the Moors, and helping capture Ceuta in 1420. However, after giving birth to a son, Diego, she died. Columbus returned to Lisbon, where he worked selling books and did cartography on the side. Lisbon was a hub of exploration, and the stream of ships returning from voyages further and further down the coast of Africa must have stoked some kind of interest in exploration in Columbus. In the early 1480s, he got on a ship with his brother Bartolomeo and headed south to West Africa. This was a mission of exploration and science, and although he was still only a sailor, he grew very familiar with the Portuguese caravel, which was so useful for traveling long distances. He made it as far as present-day Ghana before they turned home. The Europeans knew that the world was round. It had been mathematically proven since the days of Alexander the Great's Hellenistic descendants. Columbus must have read all about the Roman astronomer Ptolemy, who talked about celestial navigation, and the accounts of travelers like Sir John Mandeville and Marco Polo, and he came out with an interesting idea that the Western Ocean might actually be crossable. This was fed by reading the letters of an old Florentine by the name of Paolo de Pozzo Toscanelli, who insisted to the Portuguese court that it was absolutely possible to sail from Europe to China by traveling west, and that the distance was much shorter than anyone thought, maybe even 6,500 nautical miles at most. Of course, Toscanelli had never done this himself. Columbus emerged convinced that Toscanelli's idea was possible, and in 1484 he put the idea to King João of Portugal. The Portuguese had already had plenty of success with Africa, so it was risky to propose to such a harebrained scheme to them. However, the king said he'd consider it, and forwarded the plan to his scientific and mathematical advisors for study. The committee took one look at the plan and said, "Hell no, are you crazy? Your calculations are way off. Sure, you could sail to China over the sea, but you'd run out of food and water long before you ever made it." And they were right. Columbus was wrong, he just didn't know it. King João trusted his advisors and sent Columbus packing. Well, he may have been wrong, but he was a little too stubborn to give up now. What did those crusty old mathematicians in Lisbon know anyway? He'd show them. Columbus's next potential client was Spain, which, as I said in the last episode, owned the Canary Islands, and although they had no explorers themselves, they were likely going to start having an interest soon. He arrived in Cordoba in 1485 to ingratiate himself with the Castilian court, and ingratiate he most certainly did. He met and had an affair with a woman named Beatriz Enriquez de Aranha, which produced his second son, an illegitimate one, named Fernando. He also met several prominent advisors to Queen Isabel. However, the queen herself was still out of his reach until he finally gained an audience in 1486. But King Fernando of Aragon was there, and he brought a copy of Ptolemy's geography to fact-check in person. Add to this the fact that Columbus also unreasonably demanded to be named viceroy and governor of any lands discovered by him, and things weren't looking good. But the power couple monarchs promised to have the matter looked into by a scientific committee, which produced the same conclusion as the Portuguese one. So the monarchs denied his request. But the silver lining was that once the currently ongoing war with Granada was over with, they might give things another look. While he was waiting for the war to end, bad news came from Portugal. King João decided to steal Columbus's crazy idea for himself, and sent two caravels under a Flemish explorer to go west and find riches. The expedition never returned, further proving Columbus was crazy. However, they left from the Azores, which is not actually an ideal starting location, despite how far out into the Atlantic it is. You see, the winds of the Atlantic spin clockwise, and the further north you go, the stronger they blow to the east, while the further south you go, the stronger they blow to the west. Columbus knew that if he was to try and go west, he'd have to leave from the Canaries, not the Azores. Then he could take advantage of the westerly winds. He sent his brother Bartolomeo to London to propose an expedition to the English king, but Bartolomeo was captured by pirates on the way, not to be released until 1491. Things seemed worse than ever, but Columbus did not give up. During the war, he performed various services for the Spanish monarchs and waited for things to cool down. When Granada fell on New Year's Day 1492, Columbus saw the flags of Castile and Aragon raised over the Alhambra and knew his time had come. So here we are back again in Santa Fe, just a mile away from Granada, with Columbus meeting again with the king and queen. They discussed it at length, questions were asked and answered, and the decision was no. He failed to convince them, yet again. He left the court for good, dejected that his dream was at an end. Maybe France next. But not long after he left, the treasurer to King Fernando, Luis de Santangel, spoke up. He begged them to change their minds and approve the expedition. He said that it was a small risk to send a few caravels, and what if Columbus was right? What if Isabel and Fernando turned him down and he went to another court, only to discover all the riches of Asia were much closer than anyone thought? Then Spain would just look like a bunch of idiots. A few other nobles that Columbus had spent the last few years befriending also spoke up in favor of him. Finally, Queen Isabel relented, and agreed to use some of the war reparations seized from the now non-existent Granada to fund the expedition. In April of 1492, a messenger finally found Columbus traveling north to try his luck in the French court. He gave him the good news. He was hereby appointed Admiral of the Ocean Sea, and would be nominated for viceroy and governor of any land that he might discover out there. He also got a right to 1/10 of whatever goods he brought home with him. It was everything he'd ever asked for. The son of a Genoese weaver was now a Spanish nobleman. He reached the port of Palos de la Frontera a month later, and by royal decree requisitioned two ships, the Niña and the Pinta, captained by two brothers, Alonso and Vicente Pinzon, local men and experienced sailors who had helped Columbus organize the expedition. He hired a third ship, the Santa Maria, from his own pocket. It was considerably larger than the other two, about 100 tons to the Niña and Pinta's 60. All three ships had three big masts, with big square sails to catch the wind. The crew made up about 80 or so men total, with 26 on the Pinta, 24 on the Niña, and 50 on the Santa Maria. On the morning of August 3rd, 1492, they set off from Palos with enough food, water, and trading supplies to last them a year. Also aboard were the best navigational tools of the age, including a compass, an astrolabe to devise latitude, and plenty of hourglasses to check the time. Columbus made it to the Canaries, and decided to stay for about a month to make all the final preparations. The islands themselves were an interesting forerunner to the soon-to-be colonies in the New World, previously held by native peoples who had limited contact with the outside world. They had been conquered by men who had self-financed expeditions, with the ultimate goal of staking out private enterprises in these new lands. With royal approval, of course. In the places that had already been conquered, big plantations were growing sugar, staffed by African slaves and the recently subjugated natives. Finally, on the 6th of September, Columbus set off to the west. He didn't have long to wait before problems started, though, and it was rather predictable. By the end of September, there was already unrest with his crew, who were used to sailing close to land and were uneasy going for so many weeks out in the open ocean. Some thought that the foreign Columbus was more than willing to die if it meant he had a chance of being this great Spanish nobleman. Nevertheless, they kept sailing for weeks longer, but nothing was found. Unrest grew further as September became October. The Pinzon brothers told Columbus in private that if land wasn't sighted in a few more days, they might have to turn back for Europe. On October the 10th, Columbus announced to the crew that the first man to sight land would receive a coat of silk. But there was a muted reception to this. Just as things seemed to be getting pretty bad, Columbus's luck came back. Birds were sighted in the sky, a sure sight that land was nearby. By the next night, and by light of a full moon, land was finally sighted. On October the 12th, Columbus and his 80 men made for shore. He raised the banner of Ferdinand and Isabel over the newly christened island of San Salvador in the Caribbean Sea. Today, it makes up one of the islands in the Bahamas, and just in case you were wondering. However, he was soon approached by people who he assumed were Indians. After all, Columbus thought he was in Asia. They were related to the Taino people, native to the Caribbean, who I will talk about in a later episode, and they called the island Guanahani. I'll talk about their culture in detail later, but Hugh Thomas, again my source for this part, claims that Columbus noted they wore no clothes and had gold pieces hanging from their pierced noses, something that particularly grabbed his attention. They appeared battle-scarred and carried sawtooth blades and traveled in canoes carved from tree trunks. They also gave him gifts of parrots and cotton, after receiving Spanish hats and beads in return. Through crudely devised sign language, the Spanish were told that there was some great king to the south who had massive quantities of the aforementioned gold. Thomas suggests that this may have been a ploy. The battle-scarred men might have directed Columbus towards their enemies with false promises. Columbus traveled further around the island, meeting more natives who he claimed seemed mystified by his presence, asking him if he came from the sky. Columbus did the only prudent thing and kidnapped 7 of these people, keeping 1 on his crew as an interpreter. After completing a survey of the island, Columbus was unimpressed with its inhabitants, claiming that he could subjugate the whole place with 50 men if he wanted. Columbus then ventured on through the Bahamas, and although he was very disappointed to find no gold, the sights and sounds and smells of the Bahamas must have been even more impressive to him than to any modern tourist. He ventured on to a great island the natives called Colba, but he assumed to be Japan. As it turns out, he found himself in Cuba on October 28th. Like the Bahamas, the sailors remarked at its natural beauty, interesting wildlife, and even more interesting people who slept on hammocks and in houses with palm roofs. Columbus himself thought it to be the Asian mainland, though, again, he was mistaken. He sent emissaries to a nearby town with 50 houses filled to the brim with Taino people, and the local chief, the cacique, granted them warmly. They were presented with gifts of cotton and the newly discovered tobacco. His subordinate, Martin Pinzon, took the Pinta unauthorized to go look for gold on his own on November 21st, leaving Columbus to continue the trip with only 2 ships, which he did, going to the eastern tip of Cuba and finding himself near an island the Taino called Haiti, but he named La Española. Of course, we call this island Hispaniola. At last, Columbus found someone who appeared to produce gold, and the settlements of the island, of which there were many, seemed poorly defended enough to conquer. Columbus assumed that this was Japan, and he even claimed to see Chinese ships, as if he would have even known what those looked like. He also apparently was informed of warlike cannibals known as the Caribs, people who ate human flesh and collected trophies from their victims. They lived off to the east, making raids upon their Taino victims. Columbus will later claim to fight the Caribs on several occasions, although we don't really know too much about them. In any case, Columbus made sure to demonstrate his cannons and arquebus to the locals, who were very impressed. On Christmas Eve, a setback occurred. The Santa Maria ran aground on a coral reef on the northern coast of modern-day Haiti. Columbus decided to turn the disaster into an opportunity, and with the permission of a local named Guacanagari, a settlement of 40 men was founded on Christmas Day using the wreckage of the Santa Maria. Columbus called it La Navidad. On January 4th, now with only the Niña, he left his camp and continued east, where he happened to encounter Pinzon and the Pinta, who gave him what little gold he found and a few excuses for deserting him. On January 13th, the Spaniards had their first big battle with the Native Americans, though Thomas suggests the Spaniards were looking for more slaves to take home. Columbus claimed that these were the fearsome Carib cannibals he'd been told about, though they were likely just more Taino people. That same day, they set off from the Americas for good, sailing east for the Azores. Along the way, they encountered a vast tract of seaweed that threatened to ensnare their ships, and in a storm that was so bad, Columbus floated a message in a barrel in case he sunk, Columbus yet again lost sight of the Pinta. On February 17th, the Niña finally reached the Azores. Columbus had returned to Europe, a vindicated man. Though he did not go to Spain at first. Instead, he went to Portugal, where he met with King João, who must have been very, very much regretting not hiring this guy. João nevertheless greeted Columbus warmly and thanked him for discovering all of these new lands for Portugal. Wait, what? Well, it turns out that under the stipulations of the Treaty of Alasovas, which gave Castile the Canary Islands, Portugal was supposed to have been given hegemony over all islands to the south of the Canaries. It didn't stipulate anything to the west, but considering Portugal had already controlled the western islands of Madeira and the Azores, it wasn't a totally baseless claim to suggest that they should control things even further west. That was something for diplomats to hammer out, though. Columbus decided to leave before João could have him murdered and steal his information. On March 9th of 1493, Columbus finally made it back to Spain. And although Isabel and Fernando were honestly a little surprised that he'd made it, they sent him warm congratulations on a job well done. Pinzon and the Pinta had actually beat him home, and Pinzon had made sure to spread rumors about how he actually discovered America, not Columbus, before he died of syphilis within the next few days. The admiral met Isabel and Fernando in Barcelona, traveling through the cheering crowds like a Roman general on triumph, where he presented them with all the wondrous things he had collected during his travels. Among these goods were chili peppers, sweet potatoes, monkeys, parrots, gold and silver, and lastly, his 9 unfortunate Taino captives, who the royal couple had baptized. Although Columbus still maintained he had reached East Asia, a place he referred to as the Indies, the intellectuals of Spain knew he had found someplace very different. After all, it only took him 33 days to reach his destination, which was mathematically impossible given how round the earth was. No, Columbus had discovered a new world, one with riches like they had never seen before. The admiral made sure to stress just how bountiful this place was, and that if he was given another expedition to return to the colony he had, by the way, founded, he could even conquer the whole area for Spain, and Christianize its people in the process. Well, that's where I'm going to leave things for now. Cristoforo Colombo, aka Cristobal Colón, aka Christopher Columbus, was a conquering hero who achieved the great dream he'd fought so hard for. Not only that, but the way to a new, rich land was now wide open. Of course, there was still Portugal to worry about, and someone needed to go back in time to check up on the men still at Navidad. But just for today, Columbus was the man of the hour. From this story alone, though, we've already seen many problems with the man. He's clearly arrogant, and the Spanish he traveled with had little problem with enslaving random people to bring back like zoo animals. The second he laid eyes on these Indies, the admiral was already thinking about conquering them to create his own territory and enrich himself. And if that isn't in the colonizing spirit, I don't know what is. Yes, Columbus would be back to the New World, and he wouldn't be alone anymore. The seal had been broken, and the floodgates had been opened. The two continents to the west, and the millions of people who lived on them, were now on course to be irrevocably changed, for good or for bad.